Hello, and welcome to the Extinction Rebellion edition of Big Mouth. I'm Andrew Harrison, and I'm sitting in the fresh meat aisle at Tesco, giving everybody the guilt eye. And with me, I've got Sian Pattenden, who has blocked the US import section of Rough Trade in protest against vinyl air miles. Hello, Sian, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you, Andrew Harrison.
They are quite good, the Extinction Rebellion lot, though, aren't they? I went down to Oxford Circus where they had their dub reggae pink boat, and it was totally gully at Glastonbury. There was a smell of aromatic relaxing cigarettes in the air, and policemen skanking below the waist, but not above
Did
the
you
waist.
Go quite late? Because I went quite early in the morning, and they had vaguely got up, but only about three of them. And it was very, very polite and quite Surbiton.
You went to a student crusty protest early in the morning and were surprised that nobody was there.
Absolutely. Having a gander. Yeah.
It was quite nice. Are they going to bring Swampy back?
I hope so, she said. Wonder where is Swampy?
I think we should investigate. I reckon he's head of ideation at Google now.
Yeah. Who is he? Where is he? Swampy, come back.
Product evangelism. Who's our first guest today, Sian Pattenden?
Well, she writes for The Guardian and The New Statesman. She broadcasts on BBC Radio 4, and she's a graduate of the Word magazine of blessed memory. She's the best thing to come out of Greater Swansea metropolitan area since Catherine Zeta-Jones, who apparently still owns a home in Mumbles. It says that on Wikipedia.
It's true.
Hi, Jude. Welcome Hello. Back to Big Mouth. How are you?
I'm good. My mum used to teach Catherine Zeta-Jones' nieces and nephews and got the inside skinny on the wedding many
really?
Years ago.
Did
Everybody
you have to keep up with the Zeta-Joneses?
Yes. Everybody knows each other in Wales. Yeah, everybody does.
Does she come back?
Apparently so. She's got a helipad somewhere near the mains.
Really?
Apparently.
Really? So she still does drop in?
Yeah, with her interesting husband and his interesting comments.
Yeah. Oh, yes, let's not go there. We see you were just on the panel that awarded Shirley Collins the Pendrin Music Book Prize, if I've said that right, for her memoir All in the Downs, Reflections on Life, Landscape and Song. What happened there then?
Yes, so the Pendrin, but
yes, it's please fact. Correct me.
Yeah. No, racist. It's fine. Stop being racist against the Welsh
whiskey. I've got a Welsh name. She's I know Welsh. Welsh people.
I was literally paid to read about 15 books in gin, so that was nice. Only one bottle of gin. There's not too many bottles of gin.
Really
yeah, so out. Lots of books. We had to read 15.
15. Who else was
I
on
had
the panel?
Read eight of them. And I had already reviewed Shirley Collins' book and liked it very much. There's some amazing other stuff on the list. So Dan Hancock's book on grime, I think, is brilliant. I would recommend that highly. It's a fantastic list this year, a really, really good list.
Wonderful.
So yes, that was at the Larn Literary Festival.
That's right. I went there once and it was full of very lovely drunk people. Is it still the same?
Yes. I didn't go this year, but I went a couple of years ago. And you've got, you know, Suzanne Moore kind of getting drunk with some folk singer and some
allegedly.
Other whatever. Oh, yeah.
Neil
allegedly.
Morrissey was there when I was there. Neil Morrissey was hanging about. And
he used to own the pub.
Owns the Dylan Thomas pub, didn't
Not
he?
Anymore.
Oh,
I changed.
See.
It's all changed.
Oh, it's all
yeah.
changed.
Larn is a strange place. Mm. Mystical goings on.
Lovely. Also joining us is Ralph Moore, Titan of Dance Music, contributing editor of Mixmag, director of Acetate. You can tell us more about that in a second. Ralph's worked for Mixmag, the Hansard of Raving for years, and he's a comics fan on the quiet. Hello, Ralph. How are you doing?
I don't think it's on the quiet after all. not anymore. Not after coming on here a couple of times. But
true.
Yes.
Have you got your Avengers Endgame tickets yet?
Well, of course I have.
What you're betting on for the finale? It was all a dream. They have a second referendum.
I'm trying to turn off as much about it so I can just enjoy it. Like, if anyone ruins it for me, someone ruined Star Wars for me, the Han Solo death, and it was like literally
what?
2 hours before 2 hours before I went to see the film, and I was just like, so I'm hoping that doesn't happen again. It's going to be great.
That's a terrible war crime when people do that. I saw that you made it to the Chemical Brothers Return to the Heavenly Social last week on the Save the Social thing. I couldn't go.
It was one of the most joyous dance music experiences I've had in a long time, because not only is it kind of where I started with, I mean, I'm a bit too young for the Albany, but I did, you know, hang out and go to Turn Mills a lot and see the Chems when they, you know, first signed to Virgin, and met them when they first signed to Virgin. In fact, the first thing I ever said, I went to Tribal Gathering in 95 and remember as a student going up to them saying, why have you signed to Virgin?
And sellouts.
Tom said, we wanted to be on the same label as Mike and the Mechanics, which to this day I've remembered because it was a very funny line.
It's a fair point as well. Well, you're also on the quiet, not on the quiet, a Madonna expert. What's the verdict on this Median single then?
It's better than it could be, but I feel that the whole project is, it's going to do exactly what the last one did, which is do okay, but not be something that Will set the world on fire in terms of... the reality is she's going for the pop audience and kids don't like Madonna.
She needs to go full tragic ballad mode, I think. She needs to embrace her Barbara Streisand-ness.
As time goes on, it's very clear to me that my friends who are mums and dads who love Madonna and Michael Jackson and Prince, some of these things will filter to kids, but only old Madonna tracks will connect with kids. It will not be Madonna's new song with, you know... a rapper, which just won't be.
And she's always going to come back with somebody else. That's why I think it's wrong. Just come back by yourself.
If only the podcast format could convey the massive side eye Sean just gave me for saying she should embrace her tragic balladness. Anyway.
Yeah. Camp disco, that's what we want.
Yeah.
Camp disco, please. Yeah. Listeners, you might ask why we're not doing Avengers Endgame this time. The answer is very simple. We haven't seen it yet. Well, we hadn't when we recorded this show. The plan is to allow everybody to see it and then dissect it afterwards, because that's a film you just cannot discuss without ruining it, exactly as Ralph has just said. So keep an eye on your app for Avengers Endgame Big Mouth update action. But what do we have on the show this week, Sean?
Funny you should ask, Andrew. This time we're talking about Big Mouth favourite Lizzo's first album in the big time, 'Cause I Love You. Everyone is celebrating her as a body positive Amazon of hip-hop pop, but does the record measure up? We'll be looking at Channel 4's latest important drama, that's in inverted commas, Chimerica, in which fake news, geopolitics, digital media and macroeconomics collide. But is it an illuminating watch? And we've got the new album by cosmic electro synth Scouse Ladies, yes, Stealing Sheep. What's going on now they've binned the Wicker Man folk of their earlier work? And they have. Remember, you can get every edition of Big Mouth a day early by helping us to pay our studio bills on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Sign up for the price of a pint each month. Yes, it's a fiver these days, and we blame Annunziata Rees-Mogg, and we'll send you the show as soon as we've finished taking out all the mistakes. You'll get the extra bit too, exclusive to our Patreon backers this week. Jude and Ralph will be confessing to the worst people they've ever interviewed and raving about the best. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
If you're listening on Saturday, the 27th of April, it's Lizzo's 31st birthday. So happy birthday, Lizzo. If you're listening, she definitely is. Melissa Vivian Jefferson released her third album, 'Cause I Love You, last Friday, and it's a step into the mainstream after the full-on hip-hop she's made so far, with soul, funk, ballads and housey stuff on there too, and maybe even a bit of camp disco, Sean. She's an unabashedly good thing, a large lady who doesn't care what anybody thinks about that. Her previous album was called Big Girl, Small World. What do we think of 'Cause I Love You? We're going to see it after this track, Like a Girl. Nice, show me what you made of. Crazy, sexy, cool, baby, with or without makeup. Got nothing to prove, but I'ma show you how. Lizzo's 'Cause I Love You feels very much like a big grab for the big time. Jude Rogers, was she on your radar prior to this?
She was, only because of something quite strange. A couple of years ago, I published a book about pop music for kids called Pop, still available in all good outlets online. And I had to do a piece for The Observer where I had to get kids to review pop music, basically revisiting the classic Q feature or Smash Hits feature, I can't remember.
We've done them all, I think, selected.
Maybe it was Select, I remember it well. And got kids to review the hot new things for 2016. And the song that won was a song, I can't remember the name of the song. Oh, it was Big Girl, Small World, the title track, which was this quite weird three-part, slightly cosmic pop, strange thing. And the kids loved it. One of the little boys said, it sounds like a girl snail about to explode, which is a good review. And
that kind of thing should be in
any magazine now. So that's how I was aware of her then. But yeah, she seemed very much somebody who was mentioned and sort of lived in more kind of indie places,
indie
really.
Rapper, yeah.
Yeah, and she kind of, I'm sure she did something with, she was working with Bon Iver at some point, and all these people who, you know, you can't imagine this is the same person. I think it's really interesting now that here she is, like, everybody's so excited about this record, when she's been around for quite a while. That doesn't happen very often anymore, does it?
I liked their first album, which was called Lizzo Bangers. Yes. I thought that's a good title for them. What did you make of this one?
Yeah, I liked it. It was, it's pretty relentless. I wanted to absolutely love it because I think the singles have been fantastic. I have loved Juice so much. Tempo, I just absolutely adore. That's kind of, it's a song I play very loudly in my very small car on rural roads. Turn it up with the windows down. You sing,
this is when you're
sing
doing drive-bys in Abergavenny.
Drive-bys in Abergavenny, kind of swearing along with Missy Elliott. that track feels very Missy Elliott as well, doesn't it, Tempo? And that's, I think, why I've always liked her. She's the music of hers I've liked best is the music that tries to do something slightly different, slightly pushes on some of the kind of more weird sounds that, you know, you get with singers like her. It wasn't, you know, wall-to-wall bangers. You know, there are some songs that are more showing you know, her the versatility of her voice, I guess. Like, you know, the big soul, you know, there's a Jerome where she's kind of really singing and kind of, I love the way it starts actually with this big, you know, almost like show tunes finale, you know, kind of, and then the album starts. It's brilliant.
Well, she's got, I mean, so for me, the thing that's, you know, really exciting about it is a big showcase for her personality, which is a fantastic personality.
Yeah.
You know, she's funny. She's, you know, pretty much the first line you hear is never been in love before. What the fuck are feelings?
Yeah.
You know, she's like self-deprecating. And she's clearly got pipes, which we were not aware of previously. The title track is Epic Soul. She's really, really witty. Is that really what you want for a pop star now? That the music is not necessarily the main thing. The music is the platform to present a person into the world of celebrity, notoriety, presence, what she represents and things like that.
I've been trying to avoid the press about her because there are so many think pieces about her and what she represents. I read an interview with her a couple of months ago in one of the American magazines, and you know, she's a bit fed up already being seen as, you know, this vessel for representing all these different things. You know, she does represent these different things. She does talk about this stuff in her songs. But I think it's much more interesting when you kind of think, you know, is this music really good? And then from that, you know, read everything else into it, really.
Yeah. But, Sean, I mean, everything's empowering now, isn't it? Everything's like literally empowering. A cup of tea is empowering, you know, so shoes, empowering shoes. But I mean, Lizzo is one of those, you know, few people who actually just kind of walk the walk. She's not sort of a Taylor Swift sort of trying to absorb everything, but actually she was always the popular girl in the class and she was always the winner. You get the strong impression that Lizzo has always been a massive outsider and has made herself into this kind of indestructible personality because of that.
Yeah, a pop star proper, I'd say. Mm. Yeah. Old school man. And you can hear Janelle Monáe in there. You can hear Prince and Outkast. You can hear the voice of We Were Weird at School and Now We're Doing This, which is what I really like. There's a lineage. There's a Sly Stone feel to it. It's really funky. It's not just the pop thing. And there's a James. There's a sort of playing around with who can I be now? And yes, she must get burdened with the, yes, I'm going to represent this and that.
Outkast is right. It's like it, kind of seemed joy in it, the kind of feeling in it. I think I could have felt it was, it's so full on, and I've listened to it for a week.
Yes.
You know, kind of feel like you need, it's like, whoa there, yeah, you know, there's a lot of stuff. But, you know, think of, you know, Speaker Box, The Love Below, that was a record that you needed, you know, it was amazing, had big hits, but actually took quite a long time for it to all bend in.
And
but
the story's in there, it's really rude. It is funk, I think, more than pop any other way. And in that sense, actually, it's an amazing listen. It will make, I mean, I don't know everyone around the table, but if you are putting makeup onto this record, it will make you put more on, you know, one of those things, like, you put your dangly earrings around. I mean, I can do that
on a Tuesday.
Ralph, what did you make of this record? You want to put loads of makeup on?
You said whoa there. I was actually going to say whoops, because the artist that that kind of initially I discovered her through Six Music, so she wasn't quite on my radar before the Six Music support started to kick in. But the Missy Elliott artist who she tried to bring through was Tweet.
In the early 2000s.
Oh, and the thing with Tweet was the single was great, but really it was a great Missy Elliott song that happened to feature Tweet.
Mm. Is that Oops Oh My?
Yeah. And so it wasn't really about Tweet, which is why we don't remember. You remember the song, but you don't remember her. But I think in this case, it's the opposite. The personality, the songs. Like, Missy is there. And like you said, Missy is a strong presence, but Missy isn't all over the record.
But the person who is all over the record, and you're a big Prince head, is there's a lot of Prince here. And she's done it. She'd worked a bit with Prince, didn't she, very briefly?
I believe so, yeah.
And said it was the most, she'll never get over it. I'll never get over working with Prince. I mean, it does feel like it's got that, the joy and the madness of a really great Prince record.
Yeah, agreed.
I think, in an alternative universe, Lizzo is the kind of person that Prince would have discovered at some point and turned into one of his World of Prince kind of, you know, spin-off type of artist, wouldn't he?
Correct. Instead, you've got Gucci Mane. But I think the last I watched Janelle Monáe on the YouTube, I believe it's called,
YouTube.
For Coachella, and it was incredible. And I was thinking, my God, he would have been so impressed by what she's become, because she has basically become almost the best thing you're going to get. Now he's not here, like she really is that good.
My key objection to this record is that the track Boys isn't on it, which was her previous absolute five-star, you know, walloper. hilariously funny, a full-on, like, kind of 1987, 2 seconds before house music.
You know what I did? We're in the world of Spotify, aren't we? And other streaming services. I made a playlist that has all the boys' remixes that go on afterwards. So if you shuffle that, Andrew, come on.
I know. Yeah. But I just wonder whether it's been left off because that might have been a bit of empowerment too far. A little bit too much empowerment. But the record's about 35 minutes long. Yeah. It's very, very concise. Another plus point, extra half star for that, Lizzo. Don't waste my time. I actually thought it was the most fantastically enjoyable thing going, and it's not just pure wit and humour. Like, Jerome is a real heartbreaker, I thought. And you know, the idea that, like, there's this kid who's kind of slightly overreached himself trying it on with Lizzo, and
she's having none of it.
She's gently knocking him back.
She reminded me also of Bette Davis, Miles Davis' wife, who has an amazing funk album. Yeah. Seek that out if you haven't heard it. There's a real kind of, I just don't give a fuck about it. And she probably doesn't care. She would probably, because she listens to this show, add an extra 5 minutes on Andrew Harrison. Oh, 40 minutes, so that he has to listen a bit longer.
She probably would, just to warm me up.
Yeah.
We have to talk, by the way, about the cover, which presents Lizzo in the nip. She's not hiding anything at all. She's like, here's me. She's hiding the things that you can't show on a record colour, but she's this is me. There's a lot of me. And she doesn't care.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost Lucy and
Freud. Side eye, isn't it? She's going to go. Yeah. She does not take any prisoners.
So we're basically agreed we think Lizzo's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I can confirm. Yeah, Charles, absolutely right. She's a fantastic pop star, and try not to, you know, contemplate all these things mean for society and all this. You know, obviously it's important that she's around, but just embrace the fact that there's somebody like this who is having a shot with the big time properly.
Mm. Yeah, which to me it's like the ridiculous joyousness of it that, like, carries you forward. Or not, you know, there's an awful lot of empowerment music around now, and it's often very dull. And this is not dull; it's exciting and fun. Anyway, let's move on to some more music. We always ask our guests to select a tune for you, the listeners, an editor's recommendation, if you like. Jude Rogers, what have you got for us?
I've got a remix of a song off the last Robin record, called Between the Lines. And this is the Black Madonna remix, which is recently out. Black Madonna is a woman called Maria, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, Maria Stamper, who's an American DJ. And this is great. I love that Robin record. I know you've talked about it loads in this show. You've played songs off it. I was one of the judges on the Nordic Music Prize last month, and basically spent 3 hours in a room going, how can Robin not win? Oh, she has to win. She's amazing. And I love the fact that the last Robin record, Honey, is a record that still gives me so much. And that was a really good remix of one of the tracks of it. Hooray!
It's two great flavours that go great together. It's Robin and the Black Madonna with Between the Lines, Black Madonna mix.
Between the lines.
Moving on to Chimerica, it's China plus America, do you see? Channel 4's latest quality drama, getting to grips with the issues that shape our world and all that kind of stuff. Lucy Kirkwood adapts her own stage play about a war photographer who accidentally records a moment of history and what it does to him as the world around him changes. It features Alessandro Nivola as the photographer Lee Berger, Cherry Jones as a grizzled war reporter, and Sophie Okonedo as a branding expert who exists in a post-moral private world. And it sounds like this.
Journalists seek truth, and right now we need them more than ever.
In news, you don't have anything except your credibility.
You, the famous photograph.
No, I took one pretty famous photo. Tiananmen Square in 1989.
And now you took that photo, but you never understood it.
30 years ago, you sat in that square with 1,000 other people, and it's been forgotten. It's completely erased from the history books.
We're looking for him.
Who?
The tank man.
Be careful.
There are people who want to find him as much as you do.
You've made all of us look dirty. Right at the moment, we need to be immaculate.
This is a man's life we're talking about.
I keep thinking this isn't happening, and I'm going to wake up any minute, and then I don't.
Chimerica, which started on Channel 4 last week. This is the fictionalized story of a man who shot the Tiananmen Square tank picture, or somebody like him. We see him idealistically shooting the protest in Beijing, and then 30 years later, dispassionately photographing civilians in Syria as the army executes them. It emerges that he's manipulated a massive news picture right at the moment when the news needs to be immaculate, spotless and trustworthy, i.e. Trump has arrived. And seeking out the tank man, the guy who stood in front of those tanks in Tiananmen Square, becomes his only way of redeeming himself. Ralph Moore, what did you make of this? Did you enjoy it?
I did. I've only seen the first episode. Mm-hmm. The cast is amazing. It's definitely got something. I'm so busy that I really only, at the moment, I only have time to watch like a couple of things a week, which is really sad. So
I watched... You're just raving all the time.
It's not raving, it's just stuff. So, you know, Fleabag obviously got me, but this is the first, I'm fully invested in it based on the fact that I watched it last night and I watched the first half again this morning, and I do think it's really got something. I do.
Yeah. It's a politics story and a media story and a kind of an old guy gets destroyed by new media and the young people story, and remarkably, Wham play a pivotal plot.
I saw that. I saw that.
It's, you know, the fact that, you know, Wham playing China back in 86 or whatever it was becomes like a little bit of glue that knits together some of the Chinese cast, some of the Western characters. And I love the fact that a bit of sort of fluffy pop culture is actually a large part of the engine for an incredibly serious, grappling piece of drama which takes on a lot of issues.
Now, I remember being on holiday a good 10 years ago, and is it Simon Napier-Bell who used to... Yeah, so I think that's probably his proudest pop culture moment was getting that off the ground. Like, I know that for him, it was like, no one else thought of this and did it, so I did it. It's a bit like, you know, whoever the first person was to play the Pyramids, which I think was actually Jean-Michel Jarre. I mean, it's a bit of a side note, but you know what I mean? Like, the reality is you get DJs now playing at the Great Wall of China. It's like, oh, it's been done now.
Oh, God, Steve Aoki again.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, they're right to do that. I think the script is cracking. It's great.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't feel like capital I important drama, does it? You feel that partly because of the pace of it and the fact that, you know, there isn't a ticking clock. There isn't a kind of a... you know, stampeding fate coming down behind, you know, behind the key characters, you know, breathing down their neck. You feel that you're being sort of deposited into a world that's much more complicated than the one you live in, and then you realise it is the one you live in, which I find really, really compelling about it. Did you like it?
Not really. I just have a kind of problem. No, I kind of I find important dramas quite hard to get invested in, really. You can think, you know, I think something about Alessandro Nivola as well. He's just so smooth and shiny and pristine, and he's this kind of like this model has been chipped in to play this photographer. I'm not saying the kind of script isn't, you know, obviously it's a fictionalizing of what went on, and you know, I remember first really getting interested in news in about that time, like 1989, and Tank Man was such a kind of pivotal thing when you were a little kid, kind of getting into the news about that time and into journalism. But I'm just thinking ahead, thinking, right, what's the important point that's going to be made here? What's the important point that's going to be made here? And I've never warmed to him as an actor in anything, really. Maybe that's one of the main problems I've got with it. I've only seen the first episode too. I'd like to see what they do with Sophie Okinoda, because she's not hugely used at the moment. You know, she's somebody he bunks up with in a play and has a minor role otherwise. That's not a massive plot spoiler. But I like Cherry Jones. I like the and I've read that she's a, because this is based on Lucy Kirkwood's play, as you were saying earlier, and there was a male character there and they brought her in, and she's a great actress. But I just, things that, you know, I think at the end of the first episode, you see somebody and you see a particular image behind him and you think, oh, okay, it just feels all very earnest and very kind of this is about important things, and I sound like a terrible trivial person.
See, I didn't get it from that. What I got from it was like the really clever connection of major events churning around in the world connected to the very human story of a guy who's considered himself to be, you know, he's clearly an egotist, he clearly considers himself to be doing a fantastically important job. Like a lot of photographers who've been into war zones, there's a lot of, you haven't been there, man, so you don't get to have a say, man, type sort of narcissism going on there. And he's just swamped, not just by the thing that he's done, but he's swamped by the fact that the business has changed around him. He's dedicated himself to an idea of truth, and that idea of truth is being challenged everywhere. Sean, what did you think of it?
Well, what you're saying, it's about imperialism, isn't it? And it's about who owns what, who owns the image, who owns the political problem, who is going to solve it. Here's this man that thought he was going to solve something with the picture. It hasn't. He's still searching for the person that was Tank Man with the plastic bags. I really liked it because I thought it was still trying to veer away from important drama. Mm. We did 1984 and Das Boot. And compared to that, we have the Wham, you know, as this cultural... pivotal point, but it's Wham! Still, you get to see footage of Wham! Doing it.
And
you
know, also,
it knows how to tread lightly as well. Yeah. Oh, it's integral to the plot,
yeah,
as you were saying.
I mean, it's not like a Quentin Tarantino pop culture reference that we don't
and
forget.
And Madonna's
about.
Tummy, yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely meaningful. And Wham! In China was meaningful. I think because it's based on a play, Lucy Kirkwood, and then she did the script, it's been revised and edited to get it sharper and sharper and sharper. Mm. What I really hated was the graphics at the start, which go, yeah, I did think it was China and America, and you keep telling me America, and you keep putting the two words together. Could we have, you know, those things where it's really
but also, Sean, it's chimera.
Signposting.
It's chimera.
Oh, of course it's chimera.
Yeah, thing that doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's part of it. I kind of feel like it was, you know, that was hammering some points home, to be honest.
Yeah.
The one moment in it, I must say that they were my favourite bits as well, because, you know, even though Wham in China is seen as a big pop culture moment, people still laugh at it in a way, because they think, oh, it's Wham, it's a bit silly, and it's not silly. It's you know, pop culture is massively important, you know, not always bring down regimes, but kind of infiltrate.
But I think also it connects with a really important part of this this whole show, which is that it, you know, the Chinese cast are not extras, they're not backdrop, they're not background, they're fully realised characters, they're fully humanised, they're fully foregrounded with hopes and dreams, and the key male Chinese cast member, without too much of a spoiler, has a terrible, awful things have happened to him in his life that he can't escape. And the fact that, I mean, this kind of traditional drama does tend to fall back on vaguely racist stereotypes.
But that's
about
what
regimented
the drama
societies.
Is saying. Yeah. So you can't come in as a white person and own the picture. You can't own the photograph and the people in that. And that's the point of the whole thing. And I think that's why it seems really well-rounded. I do agree with Judas that the lead is, he's a bit too papery thin. It's a bit too Models Ahoy.
Well,
yeah, I kind of felt like you needed somebody who's just looks a bit like
rough
around
the
edges. Yeah, rough around the edges, maybe a little bit more damaged.
We talked on the show a few months ago about the BBC's dreadful drama Press, supposedly set in two newspapers.
Ooh.
And we had Miranda Slower on the show, and she said, "Drama always gets journalism wrong.
Yes.
Everybody's too good looking.
Yes,
everybody's too sharp, apart
from
and funny,
of course.
And also, obviously, the beauty parade that is the Big Mouth Studio. Everybody's too good looking, and everybody's either too driven or too stereotypically cynical. And actually, in this, Lee Berger, the photographer, one of the earliest things you see is that he's not completely cynical. He is a man with ideals. He just betrays them for the very, very, you know, at the worst moment, for in some respects understandable reasons. I thought it was very human and incredible like that. Unlike Press, which gave us, ooh, demon reporters.
That was awful,
bad?
Yeah.
Bloody rotters, look at them.
Yes, it's something really difficult to get right. I think you're right. It's really difficult that the balance tread that line.
Mm.
Are the press evil or are they good?
Yeah.
Well, kind of neither.
I'm hoping it's going to develop as well, because we've seen a lot of China and we've seen a lot of the inside the newsroom of a thinly veiled New York Times. We've dipped our toe into Trump world, and I hope it's going to develop along those lines and have similarly interesting and worthwhile things to say about, you know, what Trumpism has done to ideas of truth. Lots of great scripts have their kind of raison d'etre concealed early on in one line. And I think one of the Chinese characters asks Lee Berger, what happens when you get the dream of democracy? What happens when you get the democracy we all want? Mm. This is in Tiananmen Square 30 years before the action is taking place. And then we're in Trump world. Well, this is the culvert it can go down. Are we going to stick with it? I'm definitely going to stick with it.
I'll watch another one. And if the man doesn't get on my nerves too much, I think I might watch. It's only four, isn't it? It's not like it's 10.
Just don't put your glasses on and then he won't look quite so good looking.
He's just too good looking. That's our problem.
If it was 14, I wouldn't watch it. But four is fine.
Yeah, okay, fair dues.
Right, okay, let's get back to music. Ralph Moore, it's your turn to choose a track. What have you got for us and why?
Okay, so as the reviews editor remarks, other things at Mixed Mag, I do get sent a lot of records early. And so I get there's three or four big albums coming out that I'm excited about. One is obviously the Hot Chip album, and it seems like this is going to be a really big record for them, because the first single, Hungry Child, is doing really, really well. Paul Wolford has remixed that. But the album is produced by Philippe Zadar from Cassius, and he's very, very good at bringing out the best in a certain type of band.
Mm.
He did a really good job with the Beastie Boys. There's also a new Cassius album coming out, which he's worked on, obviously, because he's in Cassius. But this album, it just fizzes with positivity and summer feelings. And Hot Chip are one of those bands that often the singles are the best things that you remember, but not necessarily always the whole album. But I think this album doesn't really put a foot wrong. It's really strong.
And the album has a very cryptic title, A Bathful of Ecstasy. What's that title alluding to, Ralph, do you think?
As someone who works for Mixmag, I wouldn't have a clue.
So, Ralph, you brought in a track for us.
Yes, indeed. It's the current Hot Chip single, which is called Hungry Child.
Finally, it's been a long, strange trip for Liverpool trio Stealing Sheep. Medievalist psychedelia merchants they were in the early days, with pipes and madrigals on a debut album called Into the Diamond Sun. Then they went modernist art pop for their Not Real album and invented surrealist Morris dancing for their brilliant video Apparition along the way. Third album, Big Wows, is out now, and it's a big step into hyper fluorescent pop. A bit less Robin Hood, a bit more Robin, Black Madonna remix. What do we think? From Big Wows, this is Stealing Sheep with the single Joking Me. Harrison, tell the listeners why you chose that track.
Because you never hear Scouse accents on pop records. You haven't heard them since the Beatles. I don't know which one of the three it is singing there, but it is a clear and visible Liverpool accent. In fact, what it is, it's basically, for our younger listeners, it's basically an update of the Live the Birds theme. It's like, you're asking, you're dancing. You know, it's the same thing. And I actually found that really charming. Admittedly, not for the entire listenership, but I think we need to have more accents in pop music. We've got them all over Radio 4 now. And yet, what do you hear in pop music? Transatlantic, London, and we don't even get Mockney anymore. Been banned because of Britpop and Brexit. Anyway,
bring back the
show.
Proclaimers. Absolutely. Although they never went away, did they? Jude Rogers, Stealing Sheep's early work was all Crumhorns and Obby Horses and Mary Lloyd. They sound right up your street. Did you like this new direction?
And now they've gone all Delia Derbyshire. Yes. You know, anybody who ever read anything I've written knows that my things are weird folk music and weird electronic music. So yes, I like this very much. Jokingly, I heard when it was first played to death on Six Music, like Lizzo has been played to death on Six Music. And, you know, what an amazing, it's an amazing single. You just, as soon as I heard it, I thought, right, I can't wait to hear what comes from the record. It's brilliant. It's my favourite record of the year so far, I think. I love the Scouse. I love it. I love, you know, it's funny, the press release for it is very grand and it says, you know, we're trying to, you know, collaborate with more women and find the human in the machine and all this kind of stuff. But again, that's something that absolutely comes across in the record. It is interesting that they here's three women who've done lots of stuff with interesting female producers. They've worked with Marta Slogny on this record, who did the Björk's last record. You know, very different records. But she's somebody I interviewed a couple months ago on stage, and she's another producer and mixer who brings out really great stuff in people in bands' records. I love that there are steel pans all over this. You know, it's a very, you know, it's got
it's a pan of Scouse there, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny having this in the Lizzo album on the same show, actually, because, you know, they're very different records, but they have a sort of 80s sheen about them in many ways. Lizzo with Prince, and there's a couple of moments here. I was thinking of Jane Wiedlin's Rush Hour. You know, kind of those absolutely amazing 80s,
no bad thing,
perfect pop songs. But here you've got, you know, some weird, you know, experimental synthy stuff going on, and, you know, odd noises and all this kind of stuff.
The three women in the band share their vocals like they did in the early records, so we have a bit of that folkiness coming through, but over electronica. Did that work?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that melds in the same genre?
If you haven't heard any of their previous stuff, I don't think it matters, because it just sounds like they've created this identity, it's bonded together. It made me think a bit of, you know, Golf Rap changed their identities over different records, you know, in a bit more of a serious way quite often. This was another absolutely joyous record where, you know, you could see that they've worked together for a long time. They kind of click. There's a lovely phrase in folk music, more with people who are family members, called blood harmonies, when voices really kind of chime together. It's a lovely phrase, blood harmonies. Mm. Sounds like, you know, somebody's going to be thrown into a river quite soon. But they've got that as well, actually, even though they're obviously just they're friends, they're not relations. But they've got a really good live show coming with this as well. They've got this light up stage they're taking on tour with them. You know, they've got the same joy as International Teachers of Pop, who I also love. There's a kind of slight rough and readiness about it as well. Kind of, it's a bit more kind of early 80s do-it-yourself, putting it together, sort of an electronic pop. It's not smooth.
So you only need one more. You've got a scene, International Teachers, yeah. Stealing Sheep, and TBA.
And my new band.
And your new band, yeah. Jude Rogers' agricultural radiophonic milking shed.
Ralph, what did you think of the medieval Ladytron?
The other person that we haven't talked about who's involved is Ash Workman,
mm-hmm.
who I worked with on the Ten Snake album, but obviously before that he did the Metronomy record. So I think that my brain often thinks about something like this. You know, like you mentioned Goldfrapp, I thought about Goldfrapp. What Metronomy did really well was they managed to escape the indie ghetto,
yeah,
for want of a better phrase. And so I think a lot of acts, you know, and I look at that first Goldfrapp album was wonderful when that, you know, but they made such a leap from there to a place that you didn't expect them to go sonically, or indeed in terms of, like, you know, their popularity. So the question here is this record going to you know, propel them to a completely different place? Because they've put a lot of work in to do that. And, you know, like Metronomy can sell out the Royal Albert Hall now, you know.
Really? Wow.
Like, so yes, it's got something. I'm not familiar with the older records. I've only heard this one, but I do. It's definitely got something. I like the singles. I like it. Nothing about it feels contrived, which I think when you're making that leap is really important, because you can really hear it when bands try and make a leap, but it doesn't quite sit right. Like, it's charming and it's sweet and it's well produced.
What do you think about the banger content? Because I wasn't sure there were any bangers on this one.
Oh, joking. He's a total banger.
Oof. Oh, okay. Yeah, I've got the wrong ears.
I've
got
to go for a tapper rather than a banger.
Yeah, tapper rather than banger.
Yeah. I mean, Andrew.
That was my only reservation about it, was a little bit short on bangers, but I suppose you kind of, when you're making these kind of identity changes, when you're jumping into the metaphorical phone box and coming out with your different outfit on,
nice.
It's a question of, you know, are you jettisoning the thing that people liked you for in the first place in order to adopt the new thing? I slightly missed the weirdness of this. I enjoyed it, but I felt it wasn't as strange and bizarre and intriguing as their previous records have been. I thought it was a fantastically well-accomplished, gleaming, fluorescent, mega-pop record. You know, maybe a little bit 2002 Shoreditch, but there's nothing wrong with that. You know, because 2002 Shoreditch is only 1987 MTV with a different hat on. So I'm totally fine with that. But I felt that maybe it was lacking in the weirdness quotient, and it maybe needed the radiophonics dialed up a little bit. The weird thing is, there's a hidden track.
Yeah.
Who does hidden tracks on digital downloads? You can't hide them, though. Where do you hide them? But it's called hidden track. It's called Heartbeat, and it's a kind of an electronic pulsy thing, which to me, okay, that's the odd little grace note, the odd little sort of slice of lemon in the gin and tonic at the end of the whole thing that gives it that weird little spin. But I wanted more of that to run through it, because I felt for a lot of this record, if you took away the kind of field mice twee pop semi-harmonies, the kind of naive charm of the singing voices. If you took that away, you could quite easily transplant in there a banging belter of a Dua Lipa form, and you might have something that felt very identical. I think they're losing their identity.
No, I agree. I think there's a burden in all the close harmonies and the keeping the folk feel, and there's a song structure to it that you think, actually, could you dismantle it? The next stage is dismantle it. Take the vocals out, do something that you weren't doing and see where that goes. Because to me, I still got a lot of twee coming out of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's pop there and there's a pop gloss over it, but underneath, I thought it was very difficult for them to climb out of the indie ghetto with this one.
What do we think it was about? Because I've read a lot of stuff around the States about identity in the digital era and the meaning of the relationship between ourselves and technology. I didn't get any of that. I thought what it was about was, it's great to make a big gleaming electronic pop record. And you're the kind of person who doesn't ordinarily get to make that kind of record.
Yeah, I agree with you there, but I don't think it has to be about, you know, kind of
anything.
No, you know, I think there's lots of stuff about, you know, people's relationships and things that kind of come out. And I just like their phrasing and the kind of way they put things. You were saying about joking me, kind of just here. You know, there's, you know, he's all that, and kind of, you know, the way the people speak. And I like when you hear that in pop. I've always liked it when you hear that in pop. Oh, I love it. I think Show Love is great. I think, where is it? Just Dreaming is great. It's called Big Wows as well, which I don't know if everybody ever used that phrase when they were younger. But
Big Wow is kind of
That was something we used all the time in Swansea.
Well, it was used all the time around by us, but in a not in a complimentary way.
No, you'd not
say
at
something
all.
Like, "Oh yeah, big oh, wow, yeah. big
yeah.
wow."
Yeah, but there's
look
that kind of
done, big wow. So that sort of deprecating aspect of it, I thought didn't really stand out in the music.
Also, isn't it? It's play on words because it's the wow and flutter.
Yeah, exactly.
It's that distortion.
Yeah.
So yeah, I liked it for that. They did say that they wanted it to sound like the fizz of a lemonade bottle when you open it, and I love that idea, but I think it didn't go strange enough.
Yeah,
but you know.
Well, yeah, but then you see, here's me going, it needs to be weirder. Where's my record of hit records? No, they shouldn't listen to me if they want to be big. If they
Lizzo's
want to...
obviously got to listen to you. Though.
I think Metronomy is a really, really good reference because I think Metronomy always band. I thought, oh, this is great pop music. And I think, well, I still like it in like 5 years' time. And those songs, you know, from kind of records they made like 7 or 8 years ago still really sound fantastic now. I think this will sound
fantastic. And you think about their compatriots, whoever they are, were... The fact that my brain can't remember who any of the compatriots are suggests that that's how good Metronomy are.
But also, just come to think of it, on the banger front, the world is absolutely laden with bangers right now. And maybe the ultimate thing to do is not to do bangers. You know, when radio is so tightly formatted to be instantly grabby, when everything's Spotifyable, it's got to be you've got to tell your entire story in 6 seconds or people are not going to pay attention. If everything is in this arms race of compression and louder and more immediate and more grabby, then maybe the interesting, exciting thing to do is not to do that, is to be the three-part semi-harmony on the Mersey Ferry.
That's the Billie Eilish thing as well, though. It's just to completely strip it away.
I thought this had a sort of playfulness and the joy about it that sometimes, you know, a lot of the music can be very serious. You know, this is like the Fun Ladytron. I didn't really like
the Fun Ladytron.
Yeah, which is, who doesn't want that?
I want that. I also want Ladytron because they're so not fun. They're not here for fun. Maybe I need to play it in an open top mini touring the raves of the Northwest. That should be the thing to do.
Right, before we finish, Andrew, I believe you've got a tune to squeeze in.
I do. I'm going to squeeze a tune in. And I've got a log roll for my favourite band, just the Divine Comedy, who have a new single called Queue Jumpers from their forthcoming album, Office Politics. And it's not about Theresa May's idea of a queue jumper, i.e., you know, migrants wanting to come into the country, which she moaned about foolishly. It's about the other kind of queue jumpers, actual queue jumpers, really annoying queue jumpers, people who shove in the way. And the lyric, as you'll hear, it's like, I'm going before you because I'm better than you. I'm earning more money than you because I'm better than you. And it is... I love records that have no hidden subtext. I love records that are not allusions to anything. I love records that are about what they're about. And this is about pain in the arse people. It could come from a musical. I can imagine it in 19. I can imagine Tommy Steele singing this in 1960 as he sets out the scene of an appalling workplace, which is filled with appalling queue jumpers. So have a listen. And the album's called Office Politics, and I hope it's going to be full of records like this, possibly a tune called Hogging the Printer.
Basically, you couldn't love it more, could you?
I think he's great. He's a genius. And also, he's a hero of mine. Here's a guy who wrote a record called Middle Class Heroes. Just the only person who's ever stood up for the middle classes in pop. Because pop has this foolish kind of attachment to fake working class. You know, loads of people who are not working class pretending to be working class. Neil Hannon is a middle class chap. He does songs about being a middle class chap. There's a lot of us about. he's our Elvis. He's the middle class Elvis.
Crikey.
Yeah, our thin Elvis. Here we go. Divine Comedy and Queue Jumpers.
I jump the queue cause I'm smarter than you. I jump the queue cause I'm better than you. Red lights.
Red lights are all I see.
Red lights.
Red lights don't apply to me.
Red lights.
Red lights are just for you.
Red lights.
You stop if you want to.
Coming to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What are our guests going to do when they take the advice of Lizzo and buy themselves a bottle from the highest shelf? What are we going to be talking about over those drinks? Jude Rogers, what is your closing time chatter?
I want to talk about The Face. The Face is back. Hooray. Which I was always excited about. I know some people were thinking, how can you bring back a magazine in 2019? This is a crazy idea, you know. But it's great. It could have launched online last week. There's some really good stuff on it, and it has a real personality and character that reminds me of when I was obsessed with The Face, which was, you know, the mid-1990s. So, you know, maybe some people say, you know, past its glory days or whatever, but it, you know, every month I got The Face, you had a sense of what was going on in popular culture, not just in London, in different parts of the UK, in big celebrity, in small fringe scenes. And you've got that. You know, I am a 40-year-old woman who lives near the Brecon Beacons. I'm so in touch with pop culture, man. You know, I tried to be, obviously, as much as anybody does, but I felt like reading this, I was learning stuff. It's not patronising, it's written in an intelligent way. There's some, you know, really interesting pieces. There's a great piece about how the far-right movement is weaponising families. Fantastic piece by Claire Provost. Really good. You know, that kind of journalism in the face I always loved. There's one about OCD and psychedelics, which is quite strange. You know, some of the pieces don't quite hit the mark yet, I think. There's lots of stuff in there that has the right feel about it.
So you're saying you were into The Face in the 90s and it wasn't necessarily the glory days. I think they were the glory days of The Face.
People always say, you know, 83 or whatever, but, you know, I was five.
Well, there's a lot of tosh talked about The Face. There was a piece about it in The Guardian recently which said The Face was known for being absolutely the best, most elite thing ever, and everybody wanted to live in London and get into the Wag Club.
No.
Not true at all.
No,
the Face's glory days were when it was about the whole of Britain and it was about raves up and down the country and it was about Manchester and Liverpool and Birmingham and Bristol and, you know, Glasgow and the entire, you know, it started out this idea that we all had our nose pressed against the glass of you know, glass windows of London wanting to get in. But actually, it was at its most exciting when it was for the entire country. And it said that you might be, you know, when you're a teenager in Swansea.
Yeah, you're wearing Kirby grips in a small village outside Swansea. Yeah,
you could still be happening. And actually, Jude, you've circled back to that now because you're in Abergavenny.
I am.
And The Face is once again.
But it does remind you, you know, there's stuff going on, you know, in lots of my own places, exciting scenes. You know, one thing about moving to the sticks I've found is I'm much more invested in the culture that's around me. There's stuff going on all over the place because a lot of people like me are going there and setting stuff up and doing things. it's really good. And I wasn't sure how it would work online because there's so many magazines that have, you know, have a digital first policy. You know, how is it going to be different to Vice magazine? How is it going to be different to so many other things? But it has the right mixture of its old identity and a sort of slightly newer identity in there going on. And it's digital now and it's coming out as a quarterly print title in September. And the manifesto is really good. It's saying, you know, people want something that's, you know, takes pop culture seriously. It's not just content to fill up, you know.
I went to the new offices a few weeks ago just before it launched.
Cause are they really
obviously
shiny?
Obviously, Mixmag and Kerrang in The Face are... All one wonderful thing, except the offices are not together. So Mixmag and Kerrang are in one office. The Face are about 10 minutes away. And the team are lovely. There's stacks of the old magazines on most tables. So the reference things, which people like us, you know, are sort of slightly, you know, touchy. Maybe touchy isn't the word, but like, you know, if something like The Face is going to come back, it needs to come back right.
That's basically the point.
So if they get anything wrong, which of course they haven't, we'd be like, because that's kind of what we're here to do. The people are great. The, you know, obviously it's going to be quarterly. I said all along, you can't bring The Face back without having a tangible magazine. It doesn't need to be monthly, but it does need something. Even if it was, you know, twice a year or once a year, people like us will pay £5 to £10 for that magazine out of curiosity, and because you want the tangibility of something that. You're going to buy it like I'm going to buy it. Of course we are. We're all going to buy it. Like, Andrew, are you going to buy it?
I'm going to buy it. Of course, I'm going to try and get one for free, obviously. But I will buy it. Ralph, what's your closing time chatter?
Mixmag have me in the office once a week, and they asked me to interview Maceo Plex for the cover. Maceo Plex is a super talented house and techno producer. He has a label called LM Audio, and his first big release was called Falling, and I loved that about sort of 8-9 years ago. He's now to the point where he can warm up. Well, he was playing before Sven Vate at Time Warp a couple of weeks ago in Mannheim, and he's a really nice guy. And but beyond that, like, his heart is in the right place. The music he makes is being supported by all the big hitters in dance music. We've actually put him on the cover before. His name is Eric Estornell, and he's great.
And is this the comes with the mix CD as download rather as well? Has he done the mix?
He has. They've delivered a mix, which I think was recorded at a festival rather than the thing that I used to do, which was clear the tracks.
Yeah,
here's your 15 clear tracks. Like, we don't. There is no CD anymore. As you mentioned earlier, what we do is some of those classic mixes are, we do now go back and relicense them. So some of them are now on Spotify and Apple Music, and you can buy you know, you can buy a second an old Jamie Jones Seth Troxler mix if you want to, if you want to own it. Own it.
So the days when I can flog my spare Fergie mix CD for billions on eBay have gone.
I mean,
destroyed
the,
my revenue stream.
The final thing on that is, I don't think anyone at Mixmag has a CD player anymore.
Oh my god!
I do.
Yeah,
but and I'm sure you do. I'm sure we all do to a degree. Yeah. But I know that the only thing that makes me sad about the way that music is now is that when you used to get like a Chemical Brothers album and it would be bites to you and it would be like, you don't burn it, don't do anything with it. You put it on and it would be a moment that the office would listen to. It's the only thing that's been lost a bit now is they do listen to, you know, an essential mix or whatever, but often people are just zoning into their own stuff rather than the big moment of let's put it on the stereo.
When they bite the tape, do you? The cassette.
Yeah. Sean, what's your close time chatter?
Well, almost long story, I'll make it short. The film director, Wiz, who directed a Suede film, some other stuff, and he directed Flowered Up's Weekender, if anyone remembers that, contacted me to say I had written about Flowered Up's Weekender in an old copy in 1997 of a film magazine called Neon that lasted a year or two, if anyone remembers it.
Yeah.
So I went back and looked at some of my old magazines that have my articles in it. Couldn't find the Weekender thing at all. Don't know where that is. But I found some interviews that I had done, and it was the fact that you can't get this stuff online anymore. So there's an old Face interview I found and an old Stephen Fry in Neon. You can't get this stuff online. I've got the paper in front of me. It's here. But the amount of stuff you get from these interviews, and it's just, it's a time capsule into when people were freer to talk about things like sex and drugs, and it's just amazing. You wouldn't get this from Bobby Gillespie anymore. He talks about meeting Kylie and then says at the time the state we were in counts on his fingers: methadone, heroin, ecstasy, dextrines, cocaine. We're on five or six things. He talks about temazepam eggs and staying up for 12 days. Things like that. You just go, oh my god, of course. We don't have that because the tabloid culture now is just so high and it would be seized on. Stephen Fry talking about taking ecstasy in this one, which is hilarious, and dancing and not really feeling like it, and cocaine and going to the gym.
At the same time.
I think they were in close succession. Rather love the fact that I'm not going to put PDF out of this. I'm going to keep it in my cupboard, but tell everybody, go and find old magazine stuff. Yeah. They are a treasure trove of kind of real life, you know, we're talking about the Face, culture, class, Britain, all that sort of stuff in here that you would never be able to print online
anymore.
It's
important to remember so much stuff isn't on the internet. Yeah. There's so much stuff that
and if it was, it would blow up and there'd be a Twitter spat about it. There'd be this, that and the other.
There'd be an apology. It'd be a pathetic apology.
Oh, yes. Yes. It's, you know, the mojito. Diane Abbott's mojito.
That's
on the overground.
That's the thing I like about her.
You know, this is this is put to shame with Stephen Fry's ecstasy dancing. So there you go. It was just a world away. I'm going to look at some more old issues of the Face and stuff.
Well, my closing time chatter is about it's about Strictly Come Dancing.
Which
it's not.
Surprise.
It's not actually.
Have you been asked to join us?
Yeah, I'm joining. Yeah. No. Apparently, there's somebody on Strictly Come Dancing called Kevin something or other. And he's a love rat. Producer Elsie's nodding at me here.
They're
Kevin, what's
the one who got together with Stacey Dooley?
Yeah, I don't know who any of these people are. Anyway, love rat, Kevin, what's the name? Has been blown up all over the tabloids. And the front page of The Sun was Strictly Kev Love Rat. And of course, Strictly Kev is DJ Food, who is on the show quite a lot.
Of course.
DJ Strictly Kev, Solid Steel with Cold Cut and Strictly Kev. So all week, the papers have been saying Strictly Love Rat, Strictly Kev. And poor old Kevin. I sent it to him and he's like, yeah, you're not the first person who sent this to me. So Strictly Kev, the great Strictly Kev, he does fantastic mixes and puts out amazing records as DJ Food. Mm. He worked on the incredible Cold Cut 90 Minutes of Madness and 70 Minutes of Madness, and he's done loads of Solid Steel. Mm. So Strictly Kev is now being tabloid shamed and I think this moment needs marking. So there we go.
Sean, can I just say that the last record that Tom and Ed played was Weekender.
Oh, wonderful. I love
that mix. That's not a mix. Dorian Inski was there, journalist Dorian Inski, you know, whoever people know from the show on Romaniacs. He's put the set list of the Chemical Brothers gig on Spotify, as many songs as he could put on it, not as the actual mix, but a lot of the songs together, which I've also been playing in the car.
If you're a Spotify user, you can just type in Dorian Linsky and you'll find his stuff.
Yeah, it's fantastic, right? Yeah.
Okay, I'm afraid, is the end of the show. Patreon backers, the extra bit will be with you soon, featuring more of the best and worst people that our guests have interviewed. But Jude Rogers and Ralph Moore, thank you for coming to join us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sean, thank you for doing what you do every week. It's
thank
amazing.
You.
And producer Elsie Bath, thank you. Listeners, patron people rather, hold tight. The extra bit will be with you soon. Everybody else, we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.